The 1997 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 336, helping the rapidly expanding number of members residing outside of North America to survive and prosper in the modern world. With Don Stringham, Bill Luffmiller, Timothy Simmons, Grant Butler, Ginger Larson, Catherine Wilson, and John Aldous.
Let's start. They tell me we're not going to have a very big crowd and that some of them are still upstairs, didn't know we moved. My name's Don Stringham, and I'm kind of pinch-hitting. The original conception for this panel was to have two authors, James Lucas and Warner Woodworth, appear and to discuss their book that I'm sure many of you are aware of, Working Toward Zion, that was published about this time a year ago. And it turned out one's a busy Wall Street lawyer and the other's an academic committed somewhere else, so they just plain couldn't be here, and I'm covering for them. And we put together a very interesting panel of people who are very much involved personally in their own ways in this whole subject matter. While we're waiting, let me just make a few observations. First off, I hope you all feel like pioneers. I know the folks up front here do, and pioneers in a movement that, if the statistics are at all valid, by the year 2030, which of course will be the 200th anniversary of the Restoration, it's fully anticipated that the church will have membership of something on the order of 100 million people, and that over 90% of those will live outside of North America. And when you let that sink in and think of the implications, the staggering numbers and the problems and challenges that's going to present, it's a very interesting subject to comprehend. The profile of those people is also fairly enlightening. If you think about it, if it isn't North America, where is it, and what sort of folks are we talking about? Well, the typical member of the church in 2030, 90% of them, are expected to be dark-skinned, speak other than English as a native language, live in substandard economic circumstances, and in most cases not enjoying a very high level of education. And thus the challenge for those of us who live in far different circumstances and have been living on the, you know, the center of the Intermountain area where the heartland of the church has been all these many recent years, is going to fall to us. And thus, of course, this principle of the United Order and those that have sharing with those that do not have, and not try to cop out and expect the church as an institution to do all the work. I must pass on another insight. I'm not sure what the reason is, but I couldn't find any of my notes this morning. Had a separate file. We've been doing a lot of work in communist countries, and I'm kind of pondering here, trying to decide if it was those commies got them or it was the devil. Either way, we must be onto something pretty good here for them to disappear off the middle of my study table. But I'm going to have to wing it just a little this morning. First, let's begin with a scriptural reading, one that affects everybody that's up front here, and I hope most of you. It's from the 58th section of the Doctrine and Covenants, verses 26 through 29. For behold, it is not meet that I should command in all things, for he that is compelled in all things, the same is a slothful and not a wise servant, and wherefore he receiveth no reward. In other words, it's obviously that the initiative that we're charged with in modern scripture fits perfectly in this area because the church can't possibly do all that needs to be done. Going on, verily I say men should be anxiously engaged in a good cause and do many things of their own free will and bring to pass much righteousness. For the power is in them wherein they are agents unto themselves, and inasmuch as men do good, they shall in no wise lose their reward. But he that doeth not anything until he is commanded. You know, you don't have to wait. You're called on a humanitarian mission, in other words, I suppose, until he is commanded, and receiveth a commandment with a doubtful heart, and keepeth it with slothfulness, the same as damned. Pretty strong doctrine. Courage to take initiative. We ought not to have to be commanded in all things. And the subject that we're addressing, of course, we're looking at an absolutely overwhelming group of people in one way or another affiliated with the church and living in far different circumstances than we are. It's true the church is ramping up, and the only member of our panel who's had direct experience as part of that effort is Grant Buehler, who will be our kickoff speaker. And I will introduce everybody just before they speak, so you have in mind specifically who they are and what they, in their way, are doing. Now, none of them claim to be experts. They're all folks who have other lives and they're very busy people, etc. But each of them are involved in a different aspect of work that bears directly on this problem. And we'd hope that all of you would listen carefully. And if I can caution all our speakers to please speak directly into the mic. Some of the speakers in other programs have not done so, and then the recordings are very poor. This is going to be a bestseller, and we want to be sure everybody's on there. And for those of you who ask questions, we'd ask you to please come to the mic as well so everything is on tape. I'll turn the time over to Grant, and he'll be embarrassed if I tell you too much, but suffice it to say, Grant's a retired airline executive. He bore major responsibilities, one of the major airlines in the country. And after retirement, spent a couple of years in Eastern Europe as a missionary, but working in the church's humanitarian efforts in Eastern Europe. And we got acquainted after he came home from that a couple of years ago, and he's got the bug because I know he's been gone constantly on similar assignments in a lot of other parts of the world ever since. And I'm sure you'll enjoy hearing what Grant has to say upon this very specific subject from both someone who's done a lot on his own and who has served inside the church program. Grant?
Thank you, Don. I'd like to preface my remarks by just saying I'm not a missionary at the present time. I no longer am serving in any official capacity, and so I don't represent the church here today. But I have spent time at church headquarters for about 18 months and a church service mission working in the humanitarian service division of welfare services. And then spent another 18 months in Europe at the headquarters there. And then since I've been back, I've been somewhat involved for a while in training. And I'm presently teaching one afternoon course in cross-cultural sensitization to the missionaries who are going on foreign missions, senior missionaries. The church's humanitarian work really got its start about 10 years ago. You may remember the fast we had for the Ethiopia and another later on for Romania. And those two efforts generated a substantial fund, which was large enough that it needed some special attention in order to spend it properly and to exercise a stewardship appropriately. And so the church called in a professional to head up a humanitarian effort. It was just a one-man operation at that time. Since then, it has grown substantially. And today, there is a full staff, probably 10 people or 12 people involved in that, as well as a sort center out on the west side of town. And it's now blossomed into a program which recently was formalized when the church created what's known as the Latter-day Saint Charities, which is a separate institution, separate from the church, and which can now be registered internationally in countries where the church can't register. We can have an on-site person, a country representative, and we can now, in a sense, send stuff to ourselves and distribute them instead of working through third parties to distribute any goods that we might send, and we'll be able to handle that ourselves. And so we have a legal entity which is considered humanitarian and not religious. And I might just mention that the Latter-day Saint Charities and the humanitarian effort really is structured to deal with non-church members. If you're talking about church members, you have a welfare program run under the direction of the priesthood. But the humanitarian arm is structured to deal with non-members outside the church. If you were to say, what's the mission, a statement of a Latter-day Saint Charities, it would be something like this. First of all, to dispense life-sustaining food, clothing, medical, and basic emergency supplies. When people are in deep trouble and they need some life-rescuing effort, that is first on the list. To provide needed expertise through volunteers, missionaries. To contribute financial assistance. To improve education and literature. That's literacy. That's one focus. Another is to promote good health practices. To assist in finding employment and vocational training opportunities. To encourage improved food production and storage. To foster resource management and self-employment. And to strengthen social and emotional well-being. Notice the similarity there between that and many of the objectives of our own welfare program. This morning, I'd like to just focus on some problems that are inherent in humanitarian efforts. And when I say problems, I'm talking about negative things, that the really tough issues. And if you think we're alone in facing these, I would draw your attention to the current edition of Harper's Magazine, which has an article titled Aboard the Gravy Train, and the subtitle is In Kazakhstan, the Farce That Is U.S. Foreign Aid. And if you want to read a depressing article on where our money is spent and how it's spent and how useless much of it is spent, you might want to get that and read it. The problems that I'd like to discuss, I'll put in the form of questions. If you were going to start some humanitarian effort yourselves, now they wouldn't be much different than what the church faces. First of all, where are you going to look? Where are we going to look for opportunities? They abound, as Don mentioned earlier on, virtually everywhere. Where are you going to spend your time and your effort, and your money, in trying to do some good? How do you decide where to do that? How are you going to make arrangements for it with the prevailing government and with local authorities who have to assist you? How are you going to do that? How are you going to determine the honesty and reliability of those people? That's tough. I had occasion to try to do that, and I frankly, I'm not sure how you do it. You can't look in their eyes, and you can't ask, are you honest? Because they all always are. It's a challenge just to find out who are reliable agents locally that you can work with. This article sheds light on that. How long is it going to take your project to mature? That elapsed time is important. I say that because In the world over there, you can go in today, make arrangements, talk to a government official about what you might do, and he will say, you can go to this orphanage, or you can work with this agency for large families, or whatever. And you come home and try to put together a program, and it may take you 6 months or a year to mature the program. And then you go back to talk to them, and there's a new face in the office. He doesn't know anything about you. He's not interested in what you're there for, and you're essentially starting from scratch again. We've had missionaries who have run into that problem, and I can tell you firsthand it's difficult, because then you have the question, if the project falls apart, what are you going to do? Your people are over there. They've been called on a mission. In our case, in the case of the church welfare program, what are they supposed to do now? And so it becomes an issue of training them to fall back, regroup, and begin afresh with and find a project that is worthy and get it approved and carry on. How are you going to get money for it? Generally, you don't have a big enough pocketbook to fund it yourselves, and so you need help. Turning the church doesn't always work. I found as I sat down in church headquarters that there is no dearth of great ideas that people bring along to get the church to fund. And I can also tell you they don't very often do it. But it doesn't seem to discourage. So I guess the bottom line is, if you had a project and you intend to pursue it, then it's your responsibility, and don't try to get the church to do it for you. I think this is good doctrine. The church has been given the responsibility for taking care of its own. And that's what Don alluded to. We have with members all over the world. The church has responsibility for that, clearly given us by in the Doctrine and Covenants. On the other hand, what's our responsibility or the church's responsibility for the non-members in the world? Do they have a responsibility? I don't think they do. But I think you and I do as individuals. We have the story of the Good Samaritan that clearly lays upon us the responsibility, tells us who our neighbor is, and we have a responsibility to help those people, wherever they are, or in any way we can. That's not the church's responsibility. I think the church has come into play simply to provide the muscle, the organizational ability, and the, in some cases, the wherewithal for us to do that and take care of our responsibility. Well, with that in mind, those are some of the questions. I'd just like to conclude with a project that I was involved in while I was in Europe and tell you how it turned out. The Humanitarian Services arm of the church looks for things that can, places where they can do good, can provide work in the areas that I mentioned here. We were in one of the Eastern Bloc countries. We met a translator with some early members of the church who had been there and done work had encountered this very charming gentleman who was an excellent translator, and he provided translation service for us. When we went back to that city, we met him again, and now he, because of the change that had taken place, had decided that he and his wife, who were both former instructors in the Institute of Linguistics, would start a private university. The objective of the university was to prepare young men and women to be translators between the Eastern countries and the West as in business opportunities, so that they would understand business language, they'd understand business principles, and they would understand English or German, which were the two languages that were going to be taught. They, when we met them at this time, the first year's class was in session. They had the freshmen there, and things were going well. They were optimistic, had a big staff of excellent teachers, and it is not difficult to find those kinds of people there. They have had excellent training in languages. As I recall, the class was about 70 in size, after talking to them, felt that they were, because of the objectives of the school and the fact that the church liked to get involved in things that had long-term benefit, would be an excellent opportunity for us. And so I was assigned the task of going and finding out what we ought to do. Well, I spent time with the couple, and it was apparent that they needed just some basics. The way they teach English in as far as textbooks go in Russia all through the years has been to send someone down to the British consulate, borrow some books, bring them home, and crank off on the Ditto machine copies for all the students, and then take the book back to them. They didn't have anything. That's the way this place was operating too. That was the model they had. So it became apparent they needed some books. They didn't have a Xerox machine. So we recommended that they have we buy a Xerox machine, and they used a lot of tapes, English tapes, and so we recommended some little boombox type players that they could play their tapes with, and a computer or two so that they could catalog books and so forth, and native English speakers who could come and speak the language. And that was it was approved, and so we pursued it. I had an opportunity to be there September the 1st, 1964, when when that was just happenstance, I went up to purchase the Xerox machine, and their new class was coming in, the new freshmen, and I was asked to speak to them, setting something like this. And then they brought in later the previous year's class and asked me to talk to them, and they said they didn't want the translator to translate. They wanted to see how they could handle it, and so I spoke to them, and they seemed to understand it. They were doing well. We bought them a $7,000 Xerox machine, and they were overwhelmed. It was like kids with a new toy. And we brought the little boom boxes, and the teachers put them in the rooms and played the tapes, and they were excited. Well, it came time now to try to get some books for them. The church has made arrangements. In fact, the book publishers have come to the church and said, we have these overruns of textbooks. We'd be glad to donate them to you if you'll ensure us that they're going outside of the United States. We don't want them to be competition next year. So the church has a large supply of books. They sent a list over of what they had, and I worked with the head of the university, and we went down through and made selections. And it turned out that the list I had was about 6 months old, so half the stuff on it was not available. And so, to make a long story short, we got whatever they sent us. And I would judge that it was about two pallets of books. We also asked for some steel shelving to put the books on. And because they were renting a three or four rooms from the Ministry of Labor or someone like that, and they were just barren rooms. And we also threw in some blackboards and things like that. Well, we found a couple from Salt Lake, admirably suited to teach not only business, but assist in the language training and assist them with the curriculum. They went over. They arrived about the time the books did, just a couple of weeks before. That was about the time I came home. Well, an interesting thing happened. The books turned out to be so valuable in that setting that the university heads completely lost track of what they were there for. They focused on the books. They would not give them to the students. They probably sold them on the black market, or sold them, wouldn't have been a black market then, but they must have been able to make so much money on those books that they began to neglect the student body, and things began to deteriorate. There was a little honeymoon period between them and the missionaries that we sent over, and then things began to go bad because the missionaries were saying, "Oh, get these books out. Let's get them to the kids, and so they can learn, and so that they can be of use." But that just seemed to cause friction between them and the university heads, and gradually it went down. They're now home. In talking with them recently, they said they didn't think the university would make it, that these books, which we thought we were doing well to send, had become such a focal point that nothing else mattered to the university, to the owners of the university, and the things were deteriorating. Well, sad story, but I wanted you to know that those are the realities when you get involved in humanitarian work. The government of the United States has spent how many billions of dollars, and how much good has come of it, I don't know. I recently, in concluding, heard, you know, about village banking, the loaning of money to peasants and mostly women to get little businesses started, and that's been very successful. We heard a retired Catholic priest talk recently who runs that program in Guatemala. And I asked him after his presentation, I said essentially, the United States and other humanitarian agencies have been working in Guatemala for 30 years at least, probably 50 years, since just after World War II. How much good has it done? That was the question I put to him. And his answer was startling to me. He said, they're worse off today than they were 30 years ago. And that's not because of the aid that's been given, but because of the political circumstances and the other economic circumstances that are there. So we've got the field's white or black. I'm not sure what color it is, but it's ready to harvest. There's plenty of work. It's a bottomless pit. It's kind of a black hole out there. But ultimately, you have to do as the Good Samaritan did, and that is find one man and take care of him, and his life's better. If you try to overhaul the whole system, it's pretty daunting. But you can still help the individual. I say this in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
Thanks, Grant. Our next speaker is at the other end of the spectrum, has never served in these kind of capacities in any official way with the church, and his name is John Aldous. He holds a master's in public administration from Princeton, and in recent years, as he's on his way towards medical school, he tells me, to probably get involved in medical services in the third world. And John has most recently been working with this type of activity sponsored by other churches. And he's going to be telling us about his experience in that setting. And, of course, the challenge here is to see what we might learn from what others are doing, what works and what doesn't. John?
Thank you. I told Don that I would talk about my experience specifically with working with the Palatine Order of the Catholic Church in Mexico. And we both thought that would be a good contribution to this panel, but I think we were both kind of begging the question of whether there's a good analogy between what bigger churches are doing now and what we'll be doing in the future. And just to sort of add a sobering footnote to the whole proceedings, the Catholic Church right now has a world population of 976 million people. And so obviously they're big, and they have a huge presence in the developing world, and that's sort of the direction we're heading. So the analogy works to some degree, but 38% of Catholic membership reside in developed countries, Europe, the United States, Canada, Oceania. So right now the Catholic Church demographically has about two sort of wealthy people from advanced industrialized countries, hypothetically working for three people that live in poor, underdeveloped countries. If the data that were presented at the beginning of this panel are correct, we're looking at a ratio of 1 to 9. So 2 to 3 versus 1 to 9. You can see that really the challenge that faces our church in the coming decades is unprecedented and daunting, to say the least. But nevertheless, I think there are lessons that we can draw from what other churches are doing. And there's a huge variety of activities going on. Primarily what I know about is the Christian churches. On the one extreme, you have Catholic Relief Services and the United Methodist Committee on Relief. Both of these organizations are basically involved in work that is entirely secular. There's not really a religious component to their ministries at all. And they're doing just the kinds of things that LDS charities are doing. They're doing education and health and funding schools and that kind of thing. In the middle of the spectrum, you have a group like Habitat for Humanity, which is a Christian ministry, but which has primarily a secular focus, building homes, but which hasn't forgotten the religious side of its ministry. It does very openly, claim to be doing the work of God, and it invites all who care to participate to do so. And it has what I think is a really wonderful kind of theology, and they call it the theology of the hammer. And the theology of the hammer goes something like this. We may disagree, the various sects of Christianity and other religions may disagree about, the road to salvation or the nature of God or something like that. But just as Christ was a carpenter, all of us who are willing to raise our hammer and be constructive and work together are invited to participate in their ministry. That's the theology of the hammer, and I think that's a nice notion and something that we would do well to adopt as we look to the developing world. And then on the more religious end of the spectrum, there's a group, for instance, called Food for the Hungry, which provides humanitarian relief, provides food for the hungry, as one might infer from the name of the organization, but which is explicitly religious. Almost everybody that participates in that organization is a born-again Christian, and their ministry is very religious, and they see that as equally important to providing relief. My specific experience is is fairly limited. But I did work last fall with the Palatine Order of the Catholic Church in Mexico. And I'm going to talk a little bit about my specific experience with the Palatines. And then I'm also going to talk about the idea of the religious order. I think that there are some real organizational advantages to the Catholic religious orders that I'm wondering if there's some way we can extrapolate those ideas to our own faith. So I'll just briefly describe my experience with the Palatines, and then I'll discuss that. I worked in the municipality of Guadalupe Calvo in southern Chihuahua in the Sierra Madre Mountains of Mexico, and that's a beautiful region. I recommend it to all of you. I was the director of a health education project. I worked with rural teachers and rural doctors, primarily the former, helping them establish in their schools. These were schools, by the way, in which the teachers were the resource. The teachers were they were it. They provided all the creative energy, all the expertise, all the learning. Normally, one teacher staffed one school, and the state of Mexico provided funding and administrative support, but the teachers were they were in these schools. And so I helped these teachers develop participatory health education programs with a strong focus on sanitation and healthy living. And basically what we did was we tried to get these teachers to participate in our program, and the carrot we held out to them was free anti-helminthic medicines. That's deworming medicines, and so and they're very costly. So that was how we sort of tried to bait them into the program originally, and hopefully the program, the fruits of the program were its own reward, and people sort of became more committed as they went along. But initially, villages would join up because they saw the opportunity to get these deworming medicines, which are very valuable, obviously we all know that healthy children that are the appropriate weight and all that sort of thing develop into healthy adults who are able to contribute. So it's a good investment, and these communities recognize that, and they participated for that reason. Unfortunately, I think, as is the case with, according to the research I've done, 80% of development projects fail. And the project I was involved in was not, an unambiguous success itself. We had lots of free riding. We had lots of people that came on board and that never really got committed to the project, and it was often the case that that we had villages drop out entirely and lapse into complete inactivity, and then somebody from our organization would come down and fire everybody up and get everybody excited and have a town meeting, and everybody would be all behind the project again, but then they would lapse again into inactivity. So there are a lot of problems, and I'm not going to go too much into that. But I had the opportunity in this capacity to travel and work a lot with the Palatines. They were actually not directly involved in my project, although they were the funders, and they were involved in the financial administration of it somewhat. I had to present a budget to the priest down there. His name was Luis Rojas, and he's a good man. But I did get a chance to travel with them quite a bit because unlike the Palatines, I didn't have access to a car, and the geographical area of the project was probably about 50 square miles over broken dirt roads. And so I did a lot of hitchhiking, and I did a lot of walking, but when possible I would travel with these Palatine missionaries, and I got a chance to talk to them a lot about what they saw as their responsibility as Catholics to their fellow Catholics, and what they saw as their responsibility to their neighbor in the more comprehensive sense. And their priorities were not surprisingly the same as the kinds of things we've been talking about. Obviously, they were really concerned about the state of health and education and the state of economic opportunity in this rural backwater of Mexico. Of course, I think you know more about where people's priorities are based on what they do rather than what they say. And they were actually doing quite a bit. They were very involved in community development. They were trying to organize local people to be able to deal more effectively with the institutions in which they exist. They did a lot of community development. They were particularly involved in trying to organize the people in the municipal capital of Guadalupe Calvo. They were trying to refurbish the Catholic rectory so that it could become more of a community resource and a nexus for people to come together and exchange ideas and that kind of thing. And so by their activities, we know that was something that they really believed in. They were also heavily they themselves weren't involved in education, but there were several Catholic-run schools in this part of Mexico. So we know that was important to them. In other areas, their commitment, while I'm sure sincere, was less manifest by their behavior. They were doing almost nothing related to health, although they were funding us. So, I mean, that's something. But that's the kind of things that the people that I worked with, the Palatine missionaries that I worked with, were concerned about. And of course, their primary concern was the religious welfare of the people of this region. Obviously, being in a remote area, a lot of these people had no access to ordained clergy, which in the Catholic Church is a huge problem. It looks to be less of a problem in our own faith, but they saw their primary mission as bringing the church to the people, bringing the sacraments to the people, and things like that. Okay, now I'm just going to take the balance of my time and briefly discuss what I see as maybe a strength of the idea of the religious order. As many of you probably know, the Palatines, like other religious orders, the Franciscans and the Jesuits, they're sort of quasi-official, but they're also kind of freelance within the Catholic Church. The Palatines are, of course, administered and run by ordained clergy, which in Catholicism means something quite different than it does in our faith. And so they sort of do speak for the Church, and they sort of bring the mantle of the Church with them. And as I said before, they do masses, and they offer sacraments to the people in these remote villages. But on the other hand, they exist independent of the central Catholic hierarchy. And this is where I see advantages in the religious order. The Palatines draw most of their funding from shrines that they have around the world. They have a huge one in Baltimore, and people contribute to these shrines, and that's the funding base of the Palatine order. And apparently they have tens of thousands of visitors a year because they have a huge budget. They're active not only here but all over the world. And they're active in projects such as the one I was involved in, health and education, those kinds of things. And so they have the independent funding base, and they have an independent chain of command. They answer not to the bishop in the geographical region in which they reside, but they answer to their own hierarchy within the Palatine order. And because they're sort of independent of the central Catholic Church, they're able to pursue their own agenda. They're able to pursue their own priorities. And in the case of the Palatines, they were very concerned about the image of St. Palatine, who was, I guess, quite a humanitarian. And so they were pursuing this humanitarian agenda. And the other thing they did is they actively recruited young Catholics. They tried to raise the consciousness of young Catholics living in the developed world, and trying to get them to participate in their ministry in Mexico and elsewhere. And so in that sense, they were trying to inculcate in young Catholics a sense of community with Catholics everywhere, and a sense of, you know, I guess if my brother is the Samaritan, if my brother is everybody that needs my help rather than people within my own religious community, that's an important point. But the Palatines were specifically, and I think legitimately, because the Catholic Church has such a huge presence abroad, they were trying to develop in young Catholics the sense that they had a special obligation to their brothers and sisters in the Catholic Church that were suffering abroad. And so they did a lot of active recruiting. They did a lot of pamphleteering on college campuses and that kind of thing to try to recruit young Catholics to volunteer and join their community. And so I guess my question, and maybe we can discuss it, or maybe we'll decide it's tangential, is what ideas can we borrow from the idea of the religious order? It's quasi-official. These people act on behalf of the Church, but it's independent. They assess needs on their own and pursue their own agenda. They have independent funding, and I guess I see real strengths in that. I mean, obviously, the focus of this workshop is more what can the individual do rather than what the institutional church can do. But it seems to me that, obviously, sort of entrepreneurship in this field is extremely difficult, and any kind of organization that facilitates this work is helpful. And it seems to me that if we're going to have a heightened sense of duty as our own membership increases abroad, there will be desire to act in sort of a capacity of Mormon of other Mormons and to act in that context. And so I really don't have any ideas. I'm just wondering what we can learn from this and what ideas we can borrow from the idea of the religious order. Thank you.
Thanks, John. Our next speaker is a businessman and farmer and rancher and a man of many talents from Idaho, Bill Loftmiller. I've recently become a colleague of Bill's in some interesting projects abroad, and I have to apologize. Bill's likely to be the first guy in Idaho who got corrupted by participating in a Sunstone function. He's got good thick skin and a heck of a guy, and is doing some marvelous things. that are outgrowths of his profession in agriculture. And we thought it might be very interesting to you to see the broad range of activities that are emerging, and hopefully it'll spark your thinking in this regard as well. Bill?
Thank you, Don. I'm happy to be here today and maybe give you a few ideas along on these subjects that you've been talking about. Just a little background on me. In my first life, I guess I'm a potato farmer in Idaho. And my humanitarian roots go all the way back to 1992 when we had a cheap potato price. And so I thought there's got to be a way to improve the price of potatoes. Then the fall of 91, we had an oversupply. That was at the time the Great Evil Empire, as it was called, was falling or had fallen. And we were told there were many, many Russians who were starving. And so we went to the governor's office. I was on the Idaho Potato Commission, and we went to the governor's office with the idea that we should give get potatoes into Russia so that they wouldn't starve, and we could improve the price in Idaho so we wouldn't starve. And that was the basis for our project. Well, as the story proceeded, Governor Andrus went to the White House, had a meeting with President Bush, or they had the Christmas dinner, and in the Christmas dinner, President Bush challenged all states to make some humanitarian gesture to the former Soviet Union. And so the governor jumped up and raised his hand, and he said, Idaho is going to send 100 tons of dehydrated potato flakes to Russia for distribution to the poor to help them out. And he came back to Idaho and called the commission office, and we happened to be there. Find 100 tons of potato flakes that will be donated to them and get them shipped to Russia and then distributed. Now, we're going to give them a half-time staff person and all the help we can, but no money. And so that was the way my humanitarian gesture began. And I thought, boy, this will be easy. This was in December. Everyone is interested in helping out their fellow man. We'll just run out and get those donated, and we'll find somebody to donate the freight, and we'll have her all done in about a month or so. And I devoted most of the next 5 months of my life, I think, to this project. And we finally, in May of 92, were able to take the 100 tons and take them to Russia. We went to Moscow and distributed them to old folks' homes, orphanages, soup kitchens, different things like that. Well, as I was there, I thought I enjoyed the people, and I thought there ought to be something I can do to help, and there ought to be something I can do in business to make a few dollars. And so I started looking for opportunities, and I met a few different people and went back again, and probably in the next 3-4 years went back for about 5 different trips, always with the idea that I was going to be able to access some of those USAID funds that you mentioned that were written in the book, but learned not very quickly, it took me, it's still trying to learn that, that that's quite a tightly held fraternity and a little hard to get into. But in the process, I met some people from Georgia, and I was trading training programs in Russia for training programs in Georgia, and they had money to train people in Georgia, and I had some folks in Russia that I wanted trained in potato growing of potato seed. And so if I agreed to donate my time and host the Georgians, they would pay the way for the Russians that I was working with to come. And in the process, I got hooked up in Georgia and spending most of my time in Georgia for the last 2 years working on projects there. Now, I have got into what I call humanitarian development because I was quickly informed by many of these humanitarian groups that we fund over there that teaching people how to grow more food is not humanitarian work. It's only humanitarian when we take and give them food if they're hungry. And development has connotations tied to business, which are really not good things. But I'd like to just give you a couple of real quick ideas, and I'm trying not to take much of the rest of the panel's time. But in wheat, in 2 years' time, we've moved them from a average yield of less than a ton per hectare to our best yield we had this year was 6 tons per hectare. In potatoes, we just by introducing a few things, we have been able to increase their yield 4 to 5 fold, which is, I think, significant. And the way that some of the organizations measure how well you're doing is by how much body weight people have gained. And I always tease the Georgians that they're going to put a scale someday on Roosevelt Avenue, and we'll just average the weight of the people walking over to see how well the economy is. But we have been able to make a significant impact in some small areas on the amount of food that they can produce on their own and is available. Now, one of the big mistakes that the U.S. government made when they went into Russia, they listened to all the Russians, and the Russians told them that the reason we are having trouble in food is we don't have good storage and good processing, and therefore we want you to spend all your money in those areas. They've now admitted that, or USDA and USAID has admitted that they believe that it was not true, that they did not produce enough in the areas, and therefore their processing and their storage were not the problem. Now, real quickly, what we can do and how we can help. Probably if you want just a little bit of exposure, take a trip and get off of the tour and go on a trip out into the country and spend some time. I've never been on a tour yet, but I've been on quite a few trips into the country. Where can a church member help? I think that if you need a little bit of structure, take a service mission and go look at and work on some of those projects. I've seen some very good ones that have been run by the church, by missionaries who are doing service work and proselyting. The next step, though, could be to sponsor a project and find something that's of interest to you, whether it be in textiles, in healthcare, in agriculture, whatever it might be. Find several people that would like to work on it, because it gets a little lonely out there once in a while when you're the only one in a project. And when you put this group together, target some interest that you really like, something you can take ownership in. And when you find that project, then find someone who is motivated more by an interest in helping his fellow man than by making money, because those that are interested only in making money usually burn out very quickly. But I can show you a man we have working in a potato project who has devoted the last 2 years of his life and is spending 5 to 6 months at a time over there and taking his family, who is making a significant difference within the country where he's working. Then the other thing you have to do is, after you take ownership, you have to give those people you work with some ownership. I'll just say in conclusion that I've had a lot of fun doing this. I've had a few adrenaline rushes, I guess, in some of the travels and different places I've been. Had indigestion once or twice by some of the things I've tried to eat. I've attended church services where the church was not organized or only existed in the fact that there were two or three members within the country, and had some interesting experiences that way. But most of all, I think I hope that I have helped my fellow man somewhere improve his life a little bit. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. Some of you are wondering how come some of us are in suits. We weren't sure whether we'd be having a happening or a wake. So I told everybody to wear their Sunday go-to-meeting clothes. Either way, we'd be safe. Next, we want to turn from the man's perspective to a couple of ladies who are really doing a terrific job with their particular focus. I hope when Catherine Sue, she'll introduce her family. They have their own rainbow coalition of adorable kids, some of which are sitting on the back row there. And little Sophie that I know isn't here right now. She's outside. She wasn't being very nice. She's the newest addition. These women, Catherine Wilson and Ginger Larson, have started on their own initiative, just housewives, as they used to tell me, who adopted children abroad and began to realize the magnitude of the unfilled needs, both to find homes for little ones that were eligible for adoption, which is a tough challenge, as they'll tell you, but also to try and do some things for those, the great number, the great majority of which have to stay behind for a number of reasons. First Catherine and then Ginger. Catherine is a full-time mom and also a full-time co-director of a project called Moms, which they'll tell you about. I know her through that primarily, and she's a very talented lady, used to be a school teacher in her prior life, and she's married to a good friend of ours who's a businessman here in town. And I'm sure you'll be fascinated with Catherine's story. And then second, right behind her, without me interfering, would be Ginger Larson, who is also the co-director. They found a comfortable way to divide responsibilities and are doing this, remember, on top of their busy mothering. Catherine?
Thank you. In the world today, there are approximately 10 million orphaned children due to warfare, famine, or other unfortunate circumstances. Every child deserves a mommy and a daddy. Every child deserves a place to call home. Yet reality cares not for what every child deserves. In 1991, I traveled to Romania for a month to adopt my first child, a beautiful little baby boy. That experience changed my life. Witnessing the pollution, the poverty, the vast amounts of orphan children, it was all very overwhelming. I came home literally with only my child and the clothes on my back. While I was there, I gave away my clothing and other items to the people that needed them much more than I did. When I returned home, I realized that I had to do something more to help the plight of the children left behind. I just didn't know what to do or where to start. My telephone rang constantly with prospective adoptive parents asking me, "How can I adopt a child? Will you please help me with the paperwork?" Of course I could. It was the least I could do. As young LDS children, we are taught to serve mankind, and most of the time we do so happily. It gives us opportunities to feel success, and hopefully it can also shape our lives so that we can realize that we need to give something back to the world instead of being on the taking end of it all the time. As we grow older, we gain more interests, more reasons to serve, and we also learn to prioritize. My telephone continues to ring 6 years after my first adoption, and the questions are still the same. Will you help me adopt a child? And how do I start? And I still do so happily, but my situation is different than it was 6 years ago. I now have a larger family. There are more needs to be met in my household, and I've had to reprioritize my time. A wonderful friend of mine, Ginger Larson, and I decided that because of our adoption experiences personally and through helping others, that we would be more effective working with a reputable adoption agency assisting international adoptions. We now work for the Families for Children Adoption Agency, located in Salt Lake City. Next, we joined forces with the Regenesis Foundation, making the dream of bringing real changes into orphans' lives one more step to becoming a reality. We're thankful to have the opportunity of working with Don Stringham and his organization, and we're looking forward to a productive union between the two groups. Since the spring of 1991, I have also given birth to a wonderful daughter, and this last May adopted a sweet little baby girl from Guatemala. Also, I have come to the realization that orphans from every country and continent need assistance, not just those that were born in Romania. So where does a person begin? I have had to realize that first and foremost, I am a wife and I am a mother. I am a person with needs. There is only so much that one individual can do. I can assist people with adoptions. It is my passion. This is what I do best. Other people's passions might include sewing, painting, building, making money, etc. A person that loves to sew can make a difference to a child in a cold, damp orphanage by sewing a cozy baby nightgown. Another might make a picture to brighten an orphanage wall, sending a care package to an orphanage with basic necessities, donating time and money to specific educational or medical projects, actually supplying the resources to free a child from a simple medical affliction that would otherwise be endured throughout their lifetime. Everyone has their unique talents. Simple pleasures in the lives of needy orphanage children mean more to them than we will ever know. Hot running water, a hard sweet candy, toothpaste, diapers, things that we take for granted are things that most children do not have. The trick in our juggling act as adults with interest is not to spread ourselves too thin, to be good at what we do, to remember the things that are the most important to us. A quote that was designed by Ginger has become my motto, and it reads, "There is no greater service to mankind than serving its children, for they are our future." And I say these things in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
I would like to share the words of a Russian folk song. May there always be sunshine. May there always be blue skies. May there always be mama. May there always be me. For over 500,000 Russian children in orphanages and millions more in other countries, these simple desires will never be a reality unless someone, somewhere, does something to alter their fate. I would like to become one of those someones. When I went to Romania almost 7 years ago to find children to adopt and love and care for, I had several life-changing experiences which led me towards my destiny. I entered several Romanian orphanages to search, and it is difficult to put into words what I felt when I did so. Imagine going into a room with 20 to 30, 1 to 3-year-old babies in dirty cribs, shaved heads, black circles under their eyes, all reaching towards me, crying out, "Mama, Mama." I can't even begin to describe the smell, the dark feeling of gloom, the hopelessness that exists there. My heart aches when I think of the children still in the orphanage that I carried my baby Lisa out of. I am haunted by the cries of those who are terrified to be lifted out of their cribs, for the only time they were ever taken out of their cribs was to receive a vaccination or a very cold, dirty bath. It's not exactly a pleasant experience during winter in an already poorly heated room. They didn't cry very much. They had learned that no loving arms would be there to comfort them. Before I went to Romania for 14 long, painful years, I desperately wanted more children, but I had 2 children from a previous marriage, and most adoption sources put low priority on people who had children already. I was overjoyed to find my 2 little girls in Romania. And what do you suppose happened to me when I returned? My phone also never stopped ringing. Day after day, people seeking to adopt would call, asking for information on how I did it, and bearing their souls with the frustrations they felt, feeling similar to my own before I left for my own Romanian adoption quest. My greatest goal became one of helping motherless children find the loving arms of caring families, and to help these families find the little ones those they so desperately sought. I worked unofficially with adopting families for over 6 years, just trying to point the right direction for them to go. Meanwhile, I found two gorgeous little brothers from Samoa who rounded out my growing family, making my life even more eventful than I had ever dreamed. After turning down at least 3 job offers with various agencies, I realized that I probably could help more if I was affiliated with an agency and helped people with international adoptions in a more professional way. I didn't realize at the time that this decision would soon lead me to a foreign land seeking better relations with orphanages there. 2 months ago, I entered a Russian orphanage for children 3 to 16 years old. This orphanage was so different from what I expected. I was surprised. I entered the beautiful pine-covered grounds of the orphanage during playtime. We were thrilled to see little children busy playing on the playground, climbing trees and eating little green apples. As the children crowded around us, anxious to see Americans, one cute little boy pointed to his brother and in perfect English said, "We're twins." 2 sets of twins had recently been adopted from that orphanage. And this young boy at the tender age of 6 understood that being a twin made him more adoptable. The orphanage director, Marina, was an absolute angel. She knew each child by name, and it was obvious that she cared for them very much. The orphanage was old and in need of paint, but it was clean and there were no bad odors. Marina smiled sweetly as she explained to us how this orphanage had been built to house 80 orphan children, but at this time she had 160 children living there. We had hired a young Russian gentleman named Sergei to help us. He was trained as a fighter pilot in the Russian Air Force, but he had never been in or near a Russian orphanage before. As he sat in the corner with 2 young 5-year-old boys, one on each knee, his wide smile slowly melted into a river of tears. And our translator explained to us that all of these beautiful little children were crying out in Russian, "Please, please find us a mommy and daddy." Marina was doing a beautiful job caring for these little ones, but still, there were many unmet needs. We saw beautiful, radiant teenage children and asked what happens to them when they're released from the orphanage at 15 or 16 years old. The translator explained to us that they had no place to go and very few prospects. So most of them would turn to crime or prostitution, for it was the only way they could survive. When I went to Russia, my goal was to establish ties with orphanages so we could help families adopt some children there. But as I left my newfound friends at the orphanage, I promised myself I would do everything possible to help those children who stayed in orphanages, the ones that would not be adopted. At times, it seems almost overwhelming trying to get families ready to go and adopt, continually searching for new contacts in other countries who are willing to help us build children's dreams into reality. Juggling my time to oversee programs in Guatemala, China, and Russia, while working to establish new ones in Honduras and Bulgaria, have become very challenging. But all the while, those radiant, smiling faces in the orphanage tug at my heart and haunt my thoughts. It is our goal to give them blue skies by helping to improve their living conditions. I am reminded of a young Eagle Scout who wanted to make a difference in someone's life. He approached a store manager with a great idea. The store would give a discount to anyone who bought thermal children's night clothes to donate to the orphanage. The store would collect the sleepers for the scout. He had already arranged for someone to deliver them to an orphanage in Russia. For 3 weeks, he arranged for scouts and Cub Scouts to pass out flyers. A large picture display of orphanage children greeted shoppers as they entered the store. The supply of sleepers was soon drained, and the store had to have more shipped in from other stores in the area. Soon they were gone, too. So they collected blankets instead. Soon over 500 sleepers and 250 blankets had been collected and delivered. Four women who donated sleepers were so touched by the pictures displayed that all four of them went to Russia to adopt children. When one of the adopted mothers entered the orphanage where she was adopting from, she saw some of the sleepers that she herself had carefully picked out to donate. This lady's donation had kept her soon-to-be-adopted baby girl warm and comfy during the time she was waiting for her new mommy to come and find her. It truly is a small world. Many of these orphanages are in desperate need of washers, dryers, blankets, paint, wallpaper, medicine, and other things that we take for granted here. There is so much that can be done. We hope to assist the special needs orphanages to receive some of the much needed medical help they now lack. Many of these children have correctable physical problems that could be fixed with modern medical treatment. We are also working on giving these special children some sunshine by helping their orphanage provide them with an improved education opportunities. Our wish list for them includes such things as puzzles, educational toys, videos, VCRs, music cassettes, players, books, computers, and software. It is our desire to give them hope for a productive future so that they can just be themselves and develop their abilities and talents as our own children would. And as I keep hearing again that folk song that the children sing merrily, may there always be sunshine. May there always be blue skies. May there always be Mama. May there always be me. We realize we cannot help all those millions of orphan children, but we can help some. Each one is priceless and special. We can make the difference in many young lives. And when one child's simple desires, voiced by this folk song, become a reality, we feel tremendous personal satisfaction. And we know that our contribution has, in some way, changed the world for the better. And out of all small things proceedeth that which is great.
Thanks, Catherine and Ginger. I was going to read you some excerpts from this terrific book, but let me, in the interest of time, just urge those of you who really want to get into the subject to acquire your own copy. It's a terrific book, and I was asked to really pitch it because these guys need the money. Not really. There's some tremendous references and reference material in the back of these books about the groups from the Mormon fold who are doing things in the third world. I think you'd be impressed. Those of you who haven't ever seen such a list, you'll be knocked on your tail, as a matter of fact, about the scale and breadth of the kinds of activities that are going on. You saw just the tip of the iceberg. We're so few in numbers that obviously we all have to go be catalysts in our own circle of friends and communities and start doing what each of us is motivated to do. Whatever little bit we can do is helped. We just barely dent the need no matter what we do. These folks up here have all had good experiences. They've all become very realistic about how difficult it is. You don't always win. In fact, statistics tell us we most of the time don't win. There's a lot of good to be done and a whole lot of fun to be had. I'm not an authority on the subject, though I've had some terrific experiences along the way. I want to add just one insight from my own experience. My children reminded me of something that I just sort of took for granted, and that was that dealing in third world situations and the interaction and so forth has some interesting side effects. In my case, it improved the bloodline. I married a woman from Austria, and that saved my kids. They'd have all looked like me and probably been as dumb as I am. Instead of that, they had a terrific mother who saved their souls, I think, as well as made their lives very different. They teased me. Pardon me? Now we need, that's what we're working on. Now, we do have a few minutes, and we intentionally left a little time for some questions and discussion. Maybe some of our panel have questions for each other, and one of our colleagues didn't make it, obviously. But if he does, we'll still give him a few minutes. But if not, let's open it for questions from the you folks who are here or for each other. We have a few minutes. If any of you have some comments or questions, we invite you to come up so the tape will pick it up. Anybody volunteer? Sure. Or speak right up. Maybe it'll pick you up.
Well, if you could just repeat it into the machine. I'm a little unclear if you were accept a call to go to, say, another country. It sounds like you're kind of an entrepreneur and a broker. Am I misreading this? If you're sponsored by the church. What can you say that you can bring from the church? You say you can't talk about the money. So, what do you have to negotiate with? That's, I guess.
The question for the tape primarily is what can you expect from the church, and what can you do to somehow interface, or are you on your own? And ask for a response from the panel. Any of you have a specific response?
Well, I would say, first of all,
Grant.
I think that I did not make clear, perhaps, that most of the projects the church engages in require them to go looking for some specific skills. It isn't. It really isn't practical for you, if I'm reading what you're asking, to go to them and say, "I'd like to do something." Unless you have some specific skills that you think there could be a market for. Otherwise, it works, it's more or less from the top down rather than from the bottom up. The church goes out through the humanitarian arm and finds the projects, and that dictates the kinds of skills that are necessary.
Does that answer your question?
Let me add a little bit. I might add just a little bit to that. I've been working somewhat with Church Humanitarian Services on a couple of ideas, and I think that Humanitarian Services is in a development mode in that they're trying to figure out what their mission is going to be under this new program where they're now organized as a private volunteer, PVO, or private volunteer organization. And one of the suggestions that I've given them and that they are reviewing now is that we have a lot of people out there with a lot of abilities in the church. And my interests are mostly agriculture, so that's what I've centered it around. But I've said, you have people who are interested in going on service missions and proselyting missions who have all this expertise. But when they get there, they try to put a program together, and it's very difficult to put a program together from Armenia or Georgia or Ukraine working backwards to the church. Let's put it together first before they go and call some of these people to that have these skills to work in and fit in with the program. And some of that is taking place, and suggestions are that there not everyone can go on a mission. Not everyone's in good enough health to go to a third world country. But we have people who would like to donate things. Okay, let's go gather some equipment, some seed, some fertilizer, some crop protection chemicals, different things. Put that program together and send the work missionary there. Same way in medical or whatever. We looked at some orphanages in Georgia, or Don did while I was there. Put the program together, then call the people that go with that. And they're very interested in working in this direction and think maybe there's some possibilities, some possibilities there in doing that.
Let me add a footnote to appreciate the comments of our panelists. The buzzword to me is networking. Yes, entrepreneurial, if that's how we want to term it, but the reality is that if we use our creativity, there's always somebody out there who can do what we need. We've learned this in business, and the people sitting here, every one of them would reaffirm what I'm saying. Just an example, these women in their adoption program doing a terrific job doing something, a bunch of crusty old lawyers and business folks, et cetera, we wouldn't be worth a diddly to them. Except, turns out that we had better access to some of the medical talent that they needed. I used to represent a lot of docs in law practice. And it was really quite simple to identify groups who were willing to, at their own expense, donate their time, pay their own way, if someone will address the infrastructure. Make sure when they go, they don't have to worry about where they're going to sleep and get a meal. And we just reached out, and they're in contact with several groups who are delighted to be part of their effort. And I use that just as an example. Or the one that Bill referred to in Georgia. Some of the kind efforts that Bill's extended and efforts got him acquainted with a fellow who in turn said, I'm a personal friend with the guy who's over this whole function in the country. I could have been there 2 weeks trying to get to this guy, and it took, a quick conversation from Bill to A to B to C, and I was over sitting in front of the minister, and I have the card of the person from their legislature who is changing the law to allow foreign adoptions. Now, that was just introductions, chain reaction, being creative, being a little aggressive. And we didn't offend anybody. We just helped each other in facilitating what we're doing. So, there's a real lesson to be gained here. Any of you who want to do something, you can do it on your own, or you can append to groups who are already doing things. And you clearly will be stymied in not being able to do everything. But you saw some good examples here this morning and have heard some very good insights expressed on where you might begin. And these good people have shared with you some insight about what they've done. And I know from personal experience with most of them that they're doing some tangible good. But probably best of all, as the scriptures teach us, the greatest blessing comes to those who are the rendering, those who render the service. Casting our bread on the waters, as the New Testament terms it. I've heard them all express that their lives have been enriched from what they've done, and our hope is through these kind of programs we'll keep the dialogue alive and provide a catalyst, and hopefully more things will occur in the future. Our challenge will not go away. From all appearances, it's going to get larger and larger.